This is another episode of Stand Up Comedy, your host and MC, celebrating 40 plus years on the fringe of show business. Stories, interviews, and comedy sets from the famous and not so famous. Here's your host and MC, Scott Edwards.
Hey, ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to the podcast. I have something exciting. A young man that is actually from right here in Northern California, Sacramento, my hometown, who got his start doing open mics in the Sacramento area and working at my club, but went on to fame and fortune doing comedy for almost 20 years. So I'm happy to have him on the show. Ladies and gentlemen, it's Brian Diamond. Brian, wow, it's so great to connect after all these years. Thank you, thank you. That's enough of the audience. Great to have you back connected. We worked together back in the late 80s and early 90s, and then you went off and kind of had an adventure in comedy, and that ended up driving you to LA for some acting work. You really had a pretty interesting career, but we're going to get to that. But just first off, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me. And you know what? And thank you for introducing me as a young man, because you may be the only one who thinks that.
Well, to me, everybody's young. No, but it's just great to one of the reasons I do this podcast is it gets a chance to reconnect. But I'm extra excited because there's been some famous people that came out of my club that started there. Carlos Alazraki, Karen Anderson, Brian Posehn, that really cut their teeth at Laughs Unlimited and are basically celebrities in at least in their own minds. You were one of those acts that started off as an open micer and after a few years working at my clubs, went on to an actual career in show business, and I want to get to that. But let's give everybody a little bit of background. Brian Diamond, you had an interest in acting, but you started off in stand-up. What kind of gave you that nudge to get on stage the first time?
You know, I wanted to do it. There was just never a place to do it. You know, here in Sacramento, I mean, before the Sacramento Kings got here, we weren't even on the map. Nobody even knew where we were. And so there was no, if you wanted to do stand up, you either had to go down, I guess, to San Francisco, I'm thinking. But I was only like 15. I didn't have a car yet. I was writing jokes and wanted to do it. It was never a place to do it.
So this was something that you actually touched on as a juvenile. I mean, as a teenager, you didn't wait until you were an adult and go, hey, geez, I want, you know, Rodney Dangerfield was 50 before he hit the stage for the first time. So this was something that you were actually thinking about before you were an adult.
Oh, I absolutely wanted to do nothing else. I wanted to be an actor and a comedian and nothing. There was no plan B.
Oh, that's cool.
I used to, you know, and I knew I was just different than the other kids watching, like the kids would watch the Brady Bunch and they would all be, Mr. and Mrs. Brady. And to me, it was Florence Henderson and Robert Reed and, you know, Christopher Knight and, you know, I mean, I knew all the actors' names, and when I watched Gilligan's Island, it was Jim Backus, and that was just, you know, an 11-year-old doesn't do that. I would always look at camera angles, and so it was.
So you had some theatrical interest and some acting in mind, and how did the comedy work into it?
I blame the Three Stooges.
Well, they had an effect on a lot of. Still have the bruises.
Yeah. I worked with a comedian one time. He had a great joke about talking about how parents used to say they'll become violent if they watch the Three Stooges. They'll become murderers. They'll become. He goes, you know what happened to me? Yeah, I became a comedian. That's what happened to me. I started writing jokes when I was maybe like 14 or 15, but I didn't get an opportunity to do it until I was 20. And somebody here in Sacramento said, "Hey, there's an open mic here in town." I'm like, "Oh my gosh!" And I found that, A, the jokes that I wrote, you know, when I was 14 or 15 are not funny for a group of strangers that are a lot older than 14 or 15. And, you know, that was like a rude awakening. And then also they were 5 or 6 years old at that point.
I'm going to interject and just say there's such a big difference between being the class clown or the funniest one in the family to performing in front of strangers and getting to make them laugh. And I'm just guessing, Brian, but as a teenager, there was probably some, you know, fart jokes or poop jokes or something, the kind of stuff that teenagers get a big laugh at, that if you went out and done it, did it in front of a bunch of adults, may not really go over.
Absolutely. You're absolutely right. They're juvenile, sophomoric jokes. The other thing too is the intimacy of, you know, you and me and everybody, we know Mike. And so when I do an impression of Mike, whoever Mike is in your family or.
Right, right.
You know, but this audience who's never met you, they don't know all these people. And so you have to find a common ground with them and pop culture and what's happening in the news. And so for me, you know, I started out doing a lot of stuff, the commercials on TV, and that's.
Oh, interesting. So, you know, where's the beef? And,
yeah.
And making fun of the old commercials back. Well, what's interesting is we're both homegrown Sacramentans, and I started my club in 1980, and we had an open mic almost immediately because I was taught that that's how you find and develop talent. You are younger than I, and you were, you know, waiting for that opportunity, but it wasn't at Laughs. You were doing some open mics at some bars and bowling alleys or whatever before you came to my club. Mm-hmm. So at least you got your feet wet and kind of realized that maybe that sophomoric humor wasn't going to work, and that's when you started working on it. Because I remember that when you did eventually end up at my club, you actually did have some material. It obviously needed work and it needed development and you needed more time, which is totally common for an open micer, but it wasn't like your first time on stage.
No, I had probably been doing it about 3 years before I got into your club.
Oh, that
and
long.
And I remember you had a bartender, I don't remember his name, but I went in and I was trying to get into your club and I said, yeah, I've performed that. And I just like made up the names of these comedy clubs. You know, I'm like 20 years old. Yeah, I've been to this. And he's just looking at me like, yeah. I wasn't ready to come to the club, but I just so badly wanted to get on stage. And I did the comedy competition, and that's how if you place in the finals, you get work at Laughs
right.
Unlimited.
That was the rule.
Yeah, and I made it to the finals, and I got 2 weeks work there. And
also, that's how I discovered you.
Correct.
See, because no offense to you, and just to make my audience a little more aware, I'm older now, and this was back when I was young, and I literally saw thousands of acts come through my door. So I don't remember personally how you came to work for me, and that's why it's one of the early questions in the podcast interview. But I think it's fascinating because the comedy competition, we called it the Great Northern California Comedy Competition. It really was, this was before the San Francisco competition. This was pretty early on. And it was a way for me to not only get people that were, let's call them wannabes, an opportunity to get on stage, because there was no restrictions. You didn't have to have a certain amount of time. You didn't have to be clean. You know, it was an open stage. If you wanted to try to juggle knives and kill yourself, hey, go for it, right? It was pretty open, the wild, wild west of entertainment. But it is true that the competition, the prizes were work at the club. And not just open mic work, but you could get a paid gig. Mm-hmm. And we had some great winners of that competition. But I think that's fascinating that that's what introduced you to me as an entertainer.
Mm-hmm. You had some heavyweights that would come out and do those competitions. And they weren't, it was called the Great Northern California. But you had people coming from Houston, Texas, and, you know, Chicago, San Francisco, Seattle. You had a lot of people coming from.
Well, when you put the prize is weeks of work at a chain of clubs, any entertainer that is worth his nut is looking for that work, looking for that paycheck. Mm-hmm. And so we didn't have any huge cash prizes. We just promised paid work. And in the comedy industry back in the 80s, that was a lot.
Mm-hmm. It was.
So it was a bit of a draw. So you did the competition. You were one of the top people. I saw you and offered you some work. Did you start off? I'm sure you started off as an opening act. Did you get a chance to develop? Did you work with any comics that kind of guided you?
Oh, absolutely. And not to sound like I'm you know, being a name dropper, but, you know, I worked with Jerry Seinfeld later on, but, you know, Willie Tyler and Lester, John Fox, Tim Jones, and
all great comics. Oh, and I'm sure you learned stuff from them.
Absolutely.
I'm always telling comics. And in fact, the book I just came out with, it says, watch other comics, listen, learn, ask questions, mm-hmm. because we're all in this industry, and there's things to be learned. I think that's, you work with some amazing people.
Yeah. And I watched, and Paula Poundstone, you know, watch, and they all had a little something different, that I could learn from, that they had a different skill set. You know, Jerry was a word tech and a technician, you know, John Fox with all his physical animation. I loved all that. I mean, his body was an instrument, you know, the way that he would tell a joke, you know, Tim Jones was just very good at working the audience, and Paula Poundstone was just an amazing improviser.
And she was kind of out there. She could take some topic and just twist it, kind of like Emo Phillips, mm-hmm. you know, take something that, that you and I would think is normal, and they would find the funny by looking at it through, the Wonderland mirror or something. You know, it's like, instead of Alice in Wonderland, it was Paula. She was amazing at that. Well, I'm so glad that you had an opportunity to work with people like that. I think it's interesting. We shared this in a different interview, but you said you and I had a little conversation, and I sat you down and gave you what advice?
You know, I remember it like it was yesterday. So you got to remember, at that time, I started doing stand-up when I was 20, and I'm maybe like 23 at this time, but still using jokes that I wrote, you know, when I was 20. And that would kill in the bars, right? But this is a comedy club now. You're not in the bars anymore. And
we had brought you to the A room.
Yes, absolutely. And you're working with these. And so you pulled me aside and said, you know, your material's a little bit crude.
And I'm so subtle.
Yeah. And I didn't understand that. But looking back now, and I remember some of the jokes that I was doing, I won't do them here. But, you know, I mean, one of them was a big Pee Wee Herman impression. Pee Wee Herman, you know, going out on a date and having relations in the
impression. Oh, Pee Wee Herman having sex. Well, yes, that sounds perfect.
Yeah. Yes. And so, but that was what I closed my show with, you know. And then, you know, a couple of the commercials that were out there. And I remember, I can say it in a clean way. Do you remember the commercial for Head and Shoulder Shampoo where the girl scratches her head and she says, and then the voiceover of the narrator says, that itch could be telling you something. And I'd say, you know, if that happened to me, I'd just think, you know, I'm even scratching her head going, hey, I wonder if I should go talk to this guy. And I said, but however, if she were to scratch herself, and I can't do it on a podcast, but scratching her genitalia, if you will, and I go, then I would say, now that itch could be telling you something. Funny when you're 21 or 22, not something that you wanted opening for.
Right, Jerry Seinfeld or somebody. Yeah. But it is true that there is a line of humor. We're taking something that everybody's aware of, like a TV commercial, you know, the Where's the Beef commercial, and some of these others. Head and Shoulders is a good example. And that's not a horrible joke. It's just that it was crude compared to what I knew you could do and what the others that would have to follow you. And it's been mentioned a couple times in the podcast, but me as the producer, it's so important to set up the acts, the headliners, so that they shine, right? And so the opening act can't be funnier than the headliner, or the featured act can't be funnier than the headliner. You want to build the energy and build the excitement. That's what a producer is all about. It's directing the entertainment so that it brings the best possible show. You know, they see the opening act and people go, that was hilarious. How can they top that? Oh, and then they see the feature and they go, oh, wow, that's, and then they see the headliner. Well, boom, they're falling out of their chairs, right? You're building to a crescendo of comedy, entertainment, and laughter. And it's all about directing the show the right way. So I'm glad I was so honest.
And well, on behalf of every comedian, thank you. And on behalf of an audience member that don't know why they enjoyed the show, they just know that they had a good time, because a lot of that stuff's invisible. It's because of that's behind the scenes. And I can tell you that as I advanced through my career and I became, you know, a headliner, I used to sit there and think, what are you thinking about putting these people in front of me? You know, what do you, you know?
Oh, I've heard that before. I was talking to Steve Bruner, who we both know is a very successful, but also one of the cleanest stand-up comics ever around. And he will do some gig in Wichita or something, and they would put up some fart fest, you know, freaking this, freaking that kind of act in front of him. And then say, okay, ladies and gentlemen, we've taken you into the toilet, and now here's Steve Bruner. Mm-hmm. And it just makes his job so much harder, and there's no reason to do that. It's unfair to the comic, and it's unfair to the audience, because you've taken them down one road, and you really want to end up on the clean road, because that's where you're going to get your success. And, you know, you're not going to become a Jerry Seinfeld or a Jay Leno by being dirty and spewing crap all the time. But bringing it back to the conversation, I always believed in trying to be honest with people, because that's how they grew. So if I took the time to sit you down and say, hey, this is a little crude, I think you can do better, it may have sounded a little harsh at the time, but it was meant to encourage you to keep writing and keep working at it. Because if I wasn't interested, and if I didn't see any spark of talent, I wouldn't have bothered. You just wouldn't have been back.
Right. I didn't appreciate it at the time, but as I got older and I looked back, I said, no, he's right. You know, I also had another person tell me, guy named John Cantu, so some of your comedy buffs will know him.
I know John.
And he's like, how long have you been doing this? Or, how much time you got? And I said, I can do, I said, I got 20. He said, how long have you been doing it? I said, 3 years. He says, no, you got five. I said, no, I got 20. You got five. You can do 20. You got five. And I was so offended. I was so offended. And then but as I got older and I look back, you and him were right. You know,
John was giving you the straight poop that when a comic thinks they have so much time, they probably have half of that.
Yes.
And because every comic wants to exaggerate their ability because they're trying to show off for the producer of the show. But we as producers realize we don't want everything you have. Mm-hmm. We want the nuggets of gold. Yes. At the base of it. Well, that's all interesting stuff. Now, you worked for me several years, and you worked way up to at least featuring. Any memories or stories about working with somebody on or off stage that you remember or have fond or bad memories of?
I would have to say I enjoyed hanging out with comedians. I didn't have any bad experiences. I always love talking about the work. To me, this was an art and a craft. For some people, you know, it was just about getting up and being funny. And I don't remember who told me this, but, you know, they set a line and says, you know, you were talking about the difference between being funny in class or funny around your family. And somebody said, you know what the difference between a joker and a professional comedian? I said, what? And he said, a joker says funny things, but a professional comedian says things funny. And so there is, people very don't thoughtful. Realize, yeah, they don't realize there's very much a craft and a science to this. The art of it is to make it look like you're just up there talking and it's stream of consciousness. And there was nobody better at it than Robin Williams. It just looked like he was up there. But I will tell you that for most comedians, it's the Rod Stewart line, where he says, my ad lib lines were well rehearsed.
Well, and Robin is a great example, but everybody thinks that he just made that stuff up on the spot. And what was great was that his mind was so quick that he could go into his mental file and come up with something funny about a word, a situation, whatever he was talking about. And he had just honed and trained such a large file of information that he, more than most, could call up jokes or funny information to share about any particular topic that came up on stage. But what I was going to bring it down to was, it's so important that the comic is doing an art form and sharing and engaging with an audience. And you can't do that if you're not being real, if you're not, there's always some exaggeration and maybe some lies in it. But it's something that the audience has to relate to and understand. And the other part of the art form, and I've mentioned this previously, so excuse me, but what makes comics good actors And the thing is that when you're on stage doing a bit that you know you've done 1,000 times to get it honed, when you're doing it in front of that audience, they think that you just came up with it. That's the acting. It's like, oh, I got a funny joke to hear. Well, the audience doesn't realize you've told that joke, you know, 5,000 times to get it Absolutely. Perfect. And that's where the acting comes in. Yes. Now, I know that you had a lot of interest in acting. And after, as part of your comedy career, you kind of took a step. You could have stayed on the road, but you decided to head down to Los Angeles and kind of tip your toe into the acting world, right?
Yeah. I all I ever wanted to do was be Paul Reiser or Michael Keaton. Those were like my, those were my heroes. And even Kevin Pollak, I could throw in there. These were stand-up comedians that were serious actors. And I wanted to do that. So you know, I was taking acting classes here in Sacramento. But yeah, I went to LA and cause you have to, I mean, you eventually at some point you got to go to New York or LA, and obviously LA was the right here in California, and I went down there but when I first got down there, I was still on the road. I was still living out of a suitcase. And I said, well, I'm not even available in town for auditions or classes or anything. So what am I going to have to make some kind of, I'm going to have to come off the road and get a job.
And that's a huge decision. I mean, I know some comics that said, I can't do this. I got to keep on the road and make a living. And I'm going to do it doing stand-up comedy. And that became their career. But you and I both know dozens of people that said, well, I've done the road and now I want to get a career in acting, but they have to make that switch and dedicate themselves and their time to acting classes and doing showcases and being seen in the area where they hope to get hired.
Mm-hmm. Well, what's also hard too is being, you know, working the clubs every night and maybe getting a couple TV shots along the way and traveling all the way to leave all that and then go get a quote unquote real job. you know, I know that for me, I hadn't had a job in 8 years and it was very, very difficult to go back. And in that time, you know, computers had come along. I mean, computers obviously been around for a very long time, but they didn't really come, you know, the internet didn't come around until 94 and, you know, Windows 95 came out in 94. By the time I went to go get a real job in 98, I didn't have any computer skills. I was out living out of a suitcase.
Oh, none of us did. Yeah.
And so what I did is what most actors do, you know, I had to go wait tables. And so I got a job wait tables. Very fortunate that I got a job in a very, very high end hotel in Beverly Hills. You know, 5-star, 5-diamond hotel, and was around all the industry. All the industry people came in there all the time.
Good way to make connections.
Well, no, actually, that
oh, really?
Was no. And I'll tell you why. We had to sign a waiver that we couldn't disclose any information. You couldn't talk to them. Well, you could talk to them, but
you can't pitch your. No. Hey, I got a movie idea.
Oh, it's not only is it tacky, you could get fired for it.
Oh, and wow. I makes sense, though.
Yeah, and I didn't realize where I was working until I started seeing the clientele come through. And I mean, everybody was in, old Hollywood, new Hollywood, old singers, new singers, old money, new money, producers in the record business, producers in the film business. And it was interesting to be around all these heavyweights and talk to them and have conversations with them, even laugh with them. And yet, I was no closer to making it than if I worked at a Denny's in South Dakota.
Yeah, that's kind of the reality of Hollywood, I think. But I think I'm interested as a listener, and I think my audience would be interested, that we always, you know, my whole life in show business, that's why I call it on the fringe of show business, is here in Sacramento. Mm-hmm. And you might as well be in the middle of Wichita, Kansas, or mm-hmm. something like that. Because once you're out of Hollywood or out of New York, depending on your line, you're nobody in the Hollywood scene. Mm-hmm. And so I had to make my own reality of entertainment in my little pond of Sacramento. But going to LA, we've all heard these nightmare stories of people going down and sacrificing for years, taking acting classes, trying to be seen, doing auditions, and some get that golden ticket and sometimes it pays off, but that's like 1 or 0.5% of the time. Absolutely. Most of them end up you know, being lifetime bartenders or waiters.
That you are spot on. You know, there's a couple of times in history that that plays out, not just in show business, but right here, you know, the gold rush. How many people came out here for the gold rush? Very, very, very few people actually made money, and many people went away more broke than they came here with. And it's the same thing with Hollywood is, and I was always a numbers guy, and I would look at the statistics and the odds and the probability of making in the business, which is a terrible thing to do in Hollywood. But I couldn't help it. I was probably more geared to be a line producer than, but I still can pursue doing it because I mean, I loved comedy and I loved acting and I still, but yeah, I mean, and it it's very, very, very difficult to get into the Screen Actors Guild. Very difficult. And then, but even if you do.
I'm going to interrupt. If you get to join the Screen Actors Guild, does that open any doors or are you just paying dues?
Great question.
Because I don't
short
know.
Answer, you pay and dues. It means absolutely nothing. And you think it's your big break. And I had somebody even tell me that. He goes, Brian, you think, because I finally did get my SAG card. And he goes, what, do you think that like everything is going to open up for you? He goes, no. He says, now you can't do non-union work. And he goes, and now, you know. And I had a friend of mine that actually got a pretty decent role in Hunt for Red October.
Okay.
And he thought, oh my gosh, this is my big break. And he says, and you know, when that door opens for you, you find there's a brick wall on the other side.
Well, I can't tell you, we were joking the other day about how many actors, they work so hard and they do so many auditions and they take so many actor training classes and they're 6 years in after waiting tables and they get their break and they're put on a sitcom. And they go out and they get that contract and they go out and they buy a house or they buy the Maserati. And then 3 months later, the show's canceled and that income stops.
Right.
Or even if they run a year or two, then it stops. Then they're, who are they?
Yeah.
They're so forgotten so quickly in Hollywood. It's always the next thing. It's not what you have done. It's what can I do to take advantage of your talent in the future?
Right.
It's a really difficult, it's so funny because to everybody else in the country, which is, you know, 99.9% of the country, Hollywood is glitz and glamour. But if you're in Hollywood, it's a cesspool of competition and people, you know, ignoring you and you have to, you're fighting up a stream of degradation to try to get any recognition. It's a hard, hard path.
Yeah.
Now, I know you did an evening at the Improv. You've done some television. You got on one of the few white comics to get on the BET network. Mm-hmm. You've had some successes that way. But did those experiences open up the doors?
You think that they, well, when you're young and naive, you think that, but you know, all those shows that not that I was on a lot, I had a handful, they come on late at night, you know? I did the show Friday Night Videos on NBC. I don't know if you remember that, where they put a comedian.
Right.
On Friday. Well, it's at 12:30 in the morning. Who's watching that? You know, I mean, and no, it really, I couldn't, nobody, you know, you bring up Bruce Smirnoff. Bruce Smirnoff had a great line one time we were working together talking about the business. And he says, anything you want to be in life, he says, I could chart a course for you. You want to be a lawyer? I could tell you, you could do this. You take this course, you take that, you go to law school, you pass the bar, you want to be an accountant and whatever career I could, he says, you want to make it in show business? There's no way to know. I mean, it's like winning the lottery. It's the right hair, the right look, the right,
oh, you know, right,
the right height. You literally can be too tall. You can be too short. You can be too fat. You can be too skinny. You can look too much like the other people that they have cast already or not enough. I mean, I think the best story that I remember seeing, Christopher Knight, who played Peter Brady on the Brady Bunch.
Uh-huh.
You know, he said, look, I can't sing. I can't dance. I've never taken an acting class. I went to a cattle call and they had, they already had the dad cast already, Robert Reed. So they needed three boys that physically resembled Robert Reed. Christopher Knight walks in and he looks, yeah, you look like you could be Robert Reed's son.
And that's how he got the gig.
And that's how he got the gig. Oh. And he beat out people that have been honing their craft, these kids that probably been taking dance lessons since they were 3 years old, playing piano since they were four. You know, and that's the way the
just Hollywood breaks.
Yeah.
It's funny you mentioned Bruce Smirnoff. We were talking about him before the show. He's a tremendous friend of mine and a very successful stand-up comic. He's done everything you'd want to do as a professional comic, TV, cruises, corporate, you name it. He's now retired in Southern Florida. But he's a great example, and I could name several, of somebody that was really good, really talented, really honed his craft as a stand-up comic, got some television shots, got some opportunities, but it just never broke to the, you know, to what we call the golden ticket, where you get a sitcom or you get something that's going to change your life. I've had a chance to work with some of those people, Jerry Seinfeld, Dana Carvey, Jay Leno, Ray Romano, Ellen, but that's such a small percentage of the really talented people I got to work with over the decades. And that's kind of the exciting and at the same time sad part of the industry, that I could name so many people that are tremendously funny, and in some ways funnier than the people that made it. Mm-hmm. But those people got the golden ticket, that magic, you know, lotto win, something happened, and now they're famous and multimillionaires. Great side example. And Brian, this interview is about you, but I want to share this. A very good friend of mine, I always say is one of the funniest people I ever got to work with, Larry Miller. Mm-hmm. He has done literally over 100 TV shows or movies. He's famous as the suck up guy in Pretty Woman. And yet Larry Miller's not famous. Larry Miller had a great career, made plenty of money, very successful actor, very successful comedian. I'm sure has no regrets. And yet nobody knows him. And yet one of his best friends, somebody he shared the funniest men in the universe with, Jerry Seinfeld and Paul Reiser, Mark Schiff is the other one. Mm-hmm. And he saw his friends get that golden ticket and get their opportunities. And it's so fickle, this industry, because you never know. It's really not about talent sometimes. It's like you said, it's just fate. I don't know.
Oh, it's really like you go to Vegas and you hit the slot machine and you make it. Really is like that. It really is. And you know, I don't want to bore your listeners with all these, but there are a lot of people that are very, very talented that you've never heard of. And that's in the music industry. That's in the comedy, the actors that will never make it above bartender or caterer, or, you know, and that doesn't mean that they don't have the skills and abilities. It just, they didn't have the right hair color. They didn't have the right height. I mean, it really does come out. We would surprise you how some people get cast on shows. And it does come down to, because you have to look at it as like you do with your comedy clubs. You say, okay, well, I'm working backwards. This is my headliner. So my feature's got to be this. My opener has to be this. And you're putting it. Well, it's the same way they put together movies and they put together sitcoms and whatnot. And you got to physically resemble. I can tell you what it works against you and for you. You could be too pretty as a female, and the leading lady says, "Well, I don't want her up." You know,
right? I don't want to compete.
And you're like, "But I killed at the audition." Yes, you did kill at the audition.
And you're very pretty.
You're very pretty. That's why you're not getting the job. You know, you could be too tall. You know, whether you're working with, you know, there's a couple of household names that are not very tall. And if you're too tall and you're, well, guess what? You didn't get, but I killed the audition. Yes, you did, but you're too tall.
Yeah. Well, we could go on and on about the ups and downs of Hollywood and acting. It's such a difficult path, but you took a shot at it and you had some opportunities. Let's bring it back to stand-up comedy. I know that you've worked stand-up comedy in all 50 states. Is that right?
Yes.
And so that
and
you've
I have
club-
the scars to prove it.
And you've worked clubs from professional A rooms like mine, mm-hmm, to the, you know, bowling alley that has comedy in the corner, yep, or the drunk strip club. Do you have any, you know, really strong positive?
Throwing a couple laundromats along the way.
Oh, laundromats. Yeah. Wow, there's a good one. I haven't heard that one. Yeah, listen, we're going to the comedy show down at the Five and Dime Laundromat. What about hell gigs? Have you had a hellacious road gig?
Oh, gosh. More than you can get. I've played more hell gigs than I have A rooms like yours.
I mean, well, there's more of them.
Yeah. You know, I mean, it's feast and famine in this business. And you think just because, you know, you're doing stuff like you're on The Tonight Show or you're on Letterman, and obviously Letterman's retired, but back that my era was the 90s. I mean, I did it all the way up till about maybe 2007, 2008, and then sporadically throughout. But anyway, my era was the 90s. So, you know, Letterman and Leno, those were the guy, Carson. These are people that, that would be on it. And then, you know, a week later, they're just playing, you know, some one night or out in the middle of Montana or Wyoming and whatnot. Like, what, you're just on the Tonight Show? Yes, I was. That's the reality.
That's the gig.
You know? And,
yeah,
and
that's I would the
see,
life.
Yeah, I'd see great musicians out at these one nighters. And I go, what are you doing out here? And they'd look at me and go, what are you doing out here? That's the, but, oh, yeah.
Any particular road story, though, that kind of stands out?
Oh, I got a couple of them. I would say, I'll preface this with, you and I had talked a little bit offline about all the factors. Well, Willie Tyler and Lester's had talked about all the things that can make a show successful, not successful.
Right. I'll shortly reiterate. So we were talking earlier before the interview that Willie Tyler and not Lester, but Willie Tyler of the Willie Tyler and Lester fame, and they've been interviewed on this podcast, had given you some advice saying that don't take each show to heart that you failed or won, because there's so many factors, including staging, lights, sound, day of the week, time of the show, audience, all those things are a factor.
What time of night you go on, who you follow.
Yeah. All that's a factor in being a successful stand-up set. That's a great thing to share, and Willie was nice to do that with you. And so how does that work into the story? What happened?
Well, one that comes to mind, I mean, the worst thing for comedy is daytime.
Oh, right.
And the second worst thing for comedy is, actually in reverse order, the worst thing is outdoors.
Oh.
Outdoors. You know, your club is intimate, low ceiling. Right. Everybody's sitting next to you. You're all tightly packed in there. You know, it's a very intimate setting. So outdoors kills, daytime is kills, and music. You know, you do not want to follow music or be associated with music unless you're in Vegas. You know, you're wearing a tuxedo. You're opening for Frank Sinatra, Anita Baker, Luther Vandross. Those were the great gigs. You know, but you don't want to be. You don't want to be opening for Tool, or Metallica or anything like that.
Yeah, because the audience is there for the music. They can care less about the crap comedian that's got to go up and kill 10 minutes. Oh, that's funny.
So I have I can remember the toughest gigs like they were yesterday. One gig I was playing, I did a week in Nebraska. Sorry, not trying to brag. It was a whole bunch of one-nighters where you went from like North Platte, Kearney, I don't remember all these towns. And one of the gigs was, it's a strip club all day long. And then at 8 o'clock on Wednesday nights, you know, or 8 o'clock on Thursday nights, they do a comedy show.
What's the audience there for?
Now you got to, I mean, they open at 12 noon and they're seeing naked ladies all day long. And then at 8 o'clock, the comedy show starts.
Ladies and gentlemen, Brian Diamond.
And I was opening at that. And there's those guys, they're not professional MCs like you. They didn't do 15, 20 minutes up front and get the audience warmed up and
get them
and
all focused.
No,
right.
It's like, y'all ready? All right, bring up, you know.
Betty, you left your G-string here.
And I'm telling you, these people do not want to see stand-up comedy. No. And I hop up on stage, and like one of the first things I hear...
I'm sorry to interrupt. Were you in front of or behind the pole? Sorry, that just came to mind.
No. I don't remember. I just remember.
Oh, I was joking.
No, I know. I'm trying to it's remember so the layout though. Of the room. But in any event, they had no use for comedy. And me being the first person up on stage, they had no use for me. And I remember I was only up on stage just a couple of minutes. And, you know, I heard somebody yell out, "Hey, you know, show us your tits."
Did they really?
Yeah. And I did. And I made 20 bucks. Yeah, I made 20 bucks.
Hey, Sparky, put some money in my pants. You want to see it? You got to pay.
And the beauty, they want me back. So, you know, everybody, no, that was.
Is so hard for comedy.
Oh gosh. It was like pulling teeth, and you know, I had to do 30 minutes and it seemed like 3 hours and 30 minutes just to get through it. And it was brutal.
That would be tough. You said there was one other.
Well,
As we revel in the tough things.
Oh, there's many. I would have to say, I got two of them for you, but one of them was right here in Sacramento.
Oh.
Of all places, of all things, the word was in Sacramento. It was at the California State Fair.
Okay.
And it's in the daytime.
Okay.
Okay. And it is, there's a band out there that's playing. There's your daytime, outdoors.
With music.
Sacramento, August, 103 degrees.
Yeah, and the heat too makes a difference.
Oh, and so the band is playing, and then they say, "Hey, we're going to take a little break, and we're going to bring out a comedian." Boo, boo! He said, I haven't even come up on stage yet. Right, people are already like yelling and no, I'm throwing stuff at the stage, and yeah, and that was just my parents. So I went up on stage, and oh, right before I go on, the guy that is booking me. He says, look, you don't have to go on. You don't have to go on. He goes, I'll give you, you know, $50 and you don't have to go on at all. And I was getting $200 to do. Like, I said, no, I need the money. You know, I said, right. Give me that mic. It was the worst decision. I should have just taken the $50. I mean, people were throwing stuff and yelling, and I couldn't even, comedy, about at least my style, because I'm from the old school, is premise, setup, punchline.
Right, right. No. You were doing it right. Yeah,
You couldn't even get your premise and your setup.
If you don't have the audience's attention, you weren't set up as a comic. You were trying to compete with the music. That is a hell gig guarantee. Now, what about like one of your best shows? Was there something that, not necessarily at Laughs Unlimited, but was there a concert or show? I know you did a couple evening, the Improvs, maybe one of those. Was there something that like you said, wow, this is why I'm in the business?
Two shows that come to mind. Yeah. I'm just picking two, but certainly there were enough good shows to keep me going for doing it for almost 20 years. But I would say two come to mind. My first tour as a professional comedian, I did it for about 5 years before I felt ready to quit my job.
Okay.
And I quit my job. My first gig as a professional was going overseas on a USO tour.
Oh, those are cool.
Yeah, entertaining the troops that were getting ready for Operation Desert Storm.
Wow. You
know, the Gulf War, the first one. And I went over there with Mo Betterman.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, Mo Betterman and I went over there. And
Mo Betterman, regular comic in Sacramento.
Yeah.
But what a great opportunity, and I could see why that would be memorable, getting a chance to entertain the troops. And unlike a state fair crowd, they were probably hungry for anything to take their mind off what was coming and to be entertained by comics. If you're in the military and you're about to go into war, it's like Bob Hope. I mean, you cannot bomb. They are so hungry for entertainment. I bet those were amazing gigs.
Yes, they were also that thing we talked about, that these aren't comedy clubs. And sometimes it was a makeshift, couple milk crates, put a plywood, portable PA system. You know, these guys are getting ready to go to war. These aren't comedy clubs. Right. So some of those were tough, and they were during the daytime, and they were outdoors.
But the crowds, wouldn't they have been a little more receiving or accepting of what the situation was, or it still made it tough because
a lot of us, when we were over in Korea, a lot of people, they were getting ready to go home. They put in their 2 year duty and now they're getting ready to go to war, and they've been notified, you're staying here with no end date and indefinitely. So a lot of them were very depressed. A lot of them didn't want, so there was those shows, but this particular one, we were out in the desert, Kuwait actually. And it was a makeshift, and all these, military guys in their fatigues. And there's not a lot of shows where people are standing there with M16s, but this particular show.
Well, down at Joe's Bar, but that's open mic night. But those would be different.
Yeah, and we had five comedians, and I went up last and did the show, and they all got up, and I thought they were all getting up to leave because I was the last comedian. The show was over, and they got up to give a standing ovation, and it was just like, oh man, it was, I got verklempt, because this is why we're out here. This is what you said, why we're bringing, these people are going into war, these troops, and this is what they needed. Just a little bit of home, a little bit of laughter. And we delivered, all five of us, we delivered.
Yeah, but the emotions that you must have felt at that moment and knowing what gift you had given those soldiers, we talk about the endorphins and the good feelings, and the energy that an audience can give an entertainer. but that situation has to be one of the most satisfying because they know and you know that their future is undetermined, and you're giving them, like you said, a little touch of home. That had to be amazing.
Yeah, it really was. And I mean, I you talked about Mark Schiff a little bit earlier.
Yeah.
Mark Schiff wrote a book. I read his book, and he talks about a similar thing going overseas. And I actually, you know, I got teary-eyed reading his book because I said, yeah, I did that. And that was probably one of the best, you know, times in my career.
That's great that you did that, Brian. Yeah. And I think it's interesting that just like any other career choice, and it doesn't matter if you're building a building or digging a ditch or whatever, whatever career choice you make, there's going to be hell gigs, days that you want to forget or go home and have a pint. And there's going to be days that you go, you know, I did something I feel good about. I succeeded at something. I completed something, whatever it is. And you get that sense of satisfaction. And in show business, I think the lows might be a little lower and the highs might be a little higher. It's all part of show business. But I think those are great stories. Thanks for sharing them.
Yeah. Well, another one that's same like that would share. I did a show. Two ladies came up to me afterwards and they said, we wanted to thank you. And I said, for what? And they said, well, our brother died 3 months ago. This is the first time that we got our mother out of the house. She's just been, you know, in a bad way for three, and you made her laugh, and we wanted to thank you. And it was like,
That's a great moment. And that was your special moment, but I want to pull off that a little bit and share with my audience that what's interesting about being a comedian or a comedy producer like me, as a club owner, I would sit back during the show and see everybody laughing. And guess what? The people I pick out were the ones that weren't laughing. And I would watch them until they broke. And you go, yes. You know, we made a difference in this person's life, at least for this time that they were there. And that in itself is satisfying. And I wasn't even a part of it. I just put together the show, but I got satisfaction out of seeing that for the time that people, it was kind of a weird goal, but the time that people are in my clubs, they're not thinking about their bills or their some fight with a relative or having to go to work or whatever. It's true escapism. If an audience is enjoying the show and the comic is doing what he's supposed to do and bringing them in and then entertaining them with stuff they can relate to, they don't even have a chance to think about all the rest of the world. They're really in that moment, you know? And we talked about that earlier, being in the moment and how important that is as an entertainer. But in stand-up comedy, it actually rackets up to another level. And having those two ladies share that with you, much like entertaining the troops, had to really feel satisfying and fulfilling as an entertainer. Congratulations. That's,
thank you.
Those kinds of moments are rare and need to be remembered.
Well, thank you. And I should thank them because, you know, and you pointed out best in the, I think you put this in your book or you must have told me, but I remember you saying something that exactly that the best times of your life are in this industry and the lowest points in your life are in this industry. And that was certainly the way that I felt over a lot of times. I mean, you can get your heart broken in Hollywood and in this business and because of all those. And so those moments, you know, you they're victories.
Are cherished.
Yeah, absolutely. And no, I love that I can even share that story, but I remember them. I have total recall. So.
Yeah, no, that's great. Well, ladies and gentlemen, it's been such a gift to have Brian jump in and be interviewed for my podcast. We had not known each other very long back in the 90s and 80s, and we have not been connected over the last several decades. So you taking the time to share your story with myself and my podcast listeners, thank you very much. It's been a privilege to get reconnected.
I absolutely agree. It's great to reconnect with you, and it's just great. It really is. And thank you so much for having me on and being able to share these stories and tell. It's been a lot of fun. Thank
you. And before we end, I know you just finished a book. It'll be out soon. Is there a title?
Yes. The name of the book is called If You Don't Know Where You're Going, You've Come to the Right Place.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, check Amazon. By the time this launches, the book will be out, and it's by Brian Diamond. That's your author, and the name of the book is?
If You Don't Know Where You're Going, You've Come to the Right Place.
That's great. Hey, thanks so much for joining us today, Brian, and keep an eye out. He's still out doing his one-man show occasionally, still entertaining, but more importantly, look for the book.
Yes. Thank you very much for having me, Scott. I really appreciate it.
Oh, our pleasure. Ladies and gentlemen, thanks for listening to the podcast. Don't forget, next Sunday, another great show for you. Thanks for listening. Bye.
We hope you enjoyed this episode of Stand Up Comedy, Your Host and MC. For information on the show, merchandise, and our sponsors, or to send comments to Scott, visit our website at www.standupyourhostandmc.com. Look for more episodes soon and enjoy the world of stand-up comedy. Visit a comedy showroom near you.